Thanks for joining me on The Pulse. I'm Bharati Jagdish. Now, a Secondary 3 Social Studies guidebook has caused a major furore. Does a person of lower socioeconomic status necessarily use Singlish or different dialects in daily conversation and play sports like soccer or basketball at local HDB estates? Does a person of a higher economic status necessarily use formal English and play tennis or golf at an exclusive country club, as the book seems to imply? Well, lots of people upset over what seems like an oversimplification. But did we all miss something in the reading of the chapter? Now, joining me to talk about this are poet, cultural critic, educator Kirpal Singh and chief editor of Channel News Asia's digital news desk, Jamie Ho. Now, pictures of a page from the book with the subheading socioeconomic status have gone viral online as netizens are criticizing the book's description of people with a lower SES, meaning socioeconomic status. The guidebook, by the way, is called Complete Guide to GCEO Level Social Studies Volume 1, published by Market Asia Books, and it defines SES, or socioeconomic status, as a factor that shapes a person's identity. But are those of us who are angry about this and calling it an oversimplification really missing the point in terms of the context all of this information was presented? Jamie, I know you have a view on this.
Yeah, so it was kind of funny because when it exploded on social media, I was like, hey, I think this looks vaguely familiar. So I went back, I checked with my daughter, and indeed, she sort of had chanced upon this last year when she was in Sec 3. This is a Sec 3 book, right?
Mm.
And also
but
by sheer coincidence.
Not given to her by the school.
No.
Okay.
And as I looked at it again, I'm like, okay. Even at that point in time, when I looked at it, I thought it was a bit odd. But as I went back and then reviewed the thing, and I thought, well, there was a certain context in which it was said. The table that was presented did look a little bit stark and gave a few laughs and chuckles, but there's a context to it. There was a point that the entire chapter was trying to make in trying to say that governments and policies and people need to be aware of these realities within any given country and be aware of choices that are made and policies that have been designed for these groups of people. So I think
choices that are made as a result of a person's socioeconomic status.
On one hand, I can see that it can be seen as a crude characterization. On the other hand, I can see why people are upset. And maybe one way to look at it is also if someone looks at this and then sees it as a definition of himself or herself, how does that person feel?
I think maybe
that's where the source of the discomfort was. If you're being told by a supposed school guidebook that you are of a particular status or other, maybe that's the crux of the unhappiness.
At the end of the day, if you just look at what was written preceding the table, it says SES can determine a person's choice of language, housing, food, entertainment, and activities. This is not untrue, right? Depending on how much money you make, you will make different choices. It can also influence the friends he interacts with. Unfortunately, that is true as well, right? Some of the choices could include the following. And then we see this table where it says people of higher socioeconomic status tend to do certain things and those in the lower socioeconomic groups tend to do other things. Is it necessarily wrong? And does that context actually help blunt the crudeness of this table, Kirpal?
Let me begin by saying that I have always believed that sometimes provocation is a very good thing in education, because provocation helps us define our own positions in a way that is not so super subtle that we can hide behind the words we use. Now, of course, some educators believe that that's not the way to educate people. So this is a very big controversy in terms of what is good and what perhaps may be at first seen to be not so good, but in the end actually be realized to be actually very good as an educational means.
So you're saying that because it has caused all this online furore, it's an opportunity to have a discussion about the issue.
Absolutely. And for young minds to know that actually in terms of social studies, broadly speaking, very few generalizations are 100% correct. There always will be exceptions. Mm. Now, I think if the writer had said that, you know, frequently we find that if you belong to this level of SES, then these are the characteristics of your conduct, then it would have been a little bit less objectionable. But it appears just from the wording of it that it's absolute. Like, you know, once you're in this, then this is automatically what you do and how you behave.
Okay, now, it does say some of the choices could include the following.
So there are provisions, right?
Yeah.
But and the people get upset because they're typecast.
Exactly. Yeah. You're typecast. Yeah. And because the table took all the attention, we didn't see what came before it. Yes. And I'm only saying this, not because I'm defending this whole thing, but we also have to consider that things do need to be looked at in context. You need to look at the words that are used, the nuances, what they imply.
See, that's the thing about the whole purpose of education, and specifically social studies, because social studies is actually meant to educate children in giving them at least a baseline of information, and then you generate the discussions about what to do about certain things, right? It's not a closed information loop, like, for example, learning about math theories, right? Mm. So in this particular case, I think people took it as a guidebook which cast in stone what is fact. And then people took umbrage at the fact that, hey, are you typecasting, as you said, Kapal? Yeah. And you're just stating this as a fact. But I think the whole purpose of social studies, which people need to look at, is that, okay, these are the facts, but what is to be done later? What is to be done about this? Let's have a discussion about this. And I think if people use this, as Kapal said, as a means to then start the discussion, then I think that's a good outcome as well.
And of course, we have to bear in mind that some people don't think these are the facts. And it's obvious that they are not. Like you said, Kapal, you know, there are many, many exceptions, very few generalizations are actually true or warranted in the first place.
Correct. However, the generalizations come to be because enough people, perhaps, or enough individuals, but with sufficient experience, have come to realize that, yes, by and large, 8 out of 10 times, what they are thinking of is true and correct. And I find that, put aside the actual reality of the position, like, is this 100% accurate or not? If it is meant to arouse, stimulate, and encourage discussion of what may be still fairly sensitive topics, right? I think it's a good thing. Because for too long, our students are given things on a plate and without the kind of, you know, parry and thrust of real argument and real discussion and real perhaps even disagreement.
No, but to be fair to the students as well, and I think I can speak with some degree of confidence, especially for social studies, the way that it has been taught has also not been helpful. Because social studies is meant to discuss social issues.
Correct.
But it is, I think, in many ways, as has been shown in this textbook, being taught in a way that you would teach any other subject.
So these didactic. Are the
facts. It's very didactic. These are the facts. Go with it, right?
Correct,
Whereas if you had done it differently, this guidebook would actually only be probably 10 pages long rather than, I don't know, 100 over pages long, right? You state out the bare minimum of facts and you let the kids have a discussion about it. I think that is the core of it. But again, I as I've always felt myself, social studies was a bit didactic, a bit too structured, a bit too right answer, wrong answer. It didn't meet its full potential.
Perhaps we don't need guidebooks.
You shouldn't have
so
guidebooks
many
for
guidebooks.
Social studies.
Yeah.
If there's one subject which I feel let's do away with the guidebook, it's social studies. If you ask me again, I will even go one step further and say, you know, for social studies, why is it even examinable? Right. Yes, you want students to have a basic knowledge of government policy, of the constraints that society faces and things like that. I think that's fine. But once you make it examinable, you judge them on their knowledge of facts.
No, not necessarily. Facts, it depends on how the exam questions are structured as well.
But the way that it is
and
done.
And how they are marked.
Exactly.
As well.
It's how they are marked. And once you're marked, you get to know that there's a right or wrong answer on social economic status.
Which is why I've always been saying this, and not just for social studies, but for many other subjects in school, there shouldn't be wrong or right answers. As long as a student is able to back up his argument, substantiate his answers, it should be accepted. And maybe let's talk about the merits of the argument you are making.
Absolutely.
Rather than whether you got the argument right or wrong.
I think the problem here, many of our teachers, and many of them actually have confessed this to me personally over the years, feel inadequate discussing issues which are seen by them, and not often wrongly, meaning that quite often rightly so, seen by them to be sensitive.
And when the teachers are also afraid of what kids will tell their parents and how the parents will
react. Repercussions, therefore. And so I think Mr. Lee Kuan Yew used to say there will come a time when Singapore will be in a position to discuss robustly topics that are sensitive. such as these, right?
But what will get us there? What will get us there, you see? So we need practice. We need that sort of exposure.
And this is where I think, I mean, I will, in a sense, defend this book. If for nothing else, that it provides a healthy room for controversy and the discussion of that controversy. Mm. I mean, are we going to be forever saying that we want to protect our young from any kind of sensitive, controversial issues in the name that these points that may be made by writers or editors of books are not sufficiently backed up by what they might call scientific evidence? But we know that in society, a lot of social issues are very difficult to pin 100% either way.
A lot of grey areas.
And
you can't say black and white. Yeah.
Correct. And I think the young should be exposed to grey areas so that they can have a healthy discussion.
So are the ones of us who are saying that this is wrong and this book is wrong?
Yeah.
not taking into account the fact that there are grey areas and it's not entirely wrong.
To be fair to the book as well, I think if you look at it, and we have it right in front of us here, Kapal and I, the vast majority of it is not controversial.
Yes.
It's factual. It's laying out societal, economic and political issues just as pure fact.
In a fairly good way.
Yeah.
Fairly systematic way.
It is a quite typical guidebook which helps kids characterize, organize information.
I can already hear the cynics and skeptics in our audience going, are you all being paid by the publishers? Getting commission, is it?
Definitely not. Definitely not.
I can assure you, no.
Yeah. Totally not.
Look at my bank account, still empty.
But, you know, I mean, it is... I perfectly take Kapal's point. I think there were many times when two of my kids, both have already gone through social studies, and they come back and they tell me about social studies, and then I wish I was there sitting in the classroom listening to the kind of things they said was happening. And I said, oh my God, I wish I was there to speak to the teacher as well, because some of the things go against the whole basis of why social studies is being taught.
Give me some examples of what these things are.
Well, for example, When especially at this level, let's say Sec 3 and Sec 4, when you put up the aims of policy, whether it is MediShield Life, whether it is housing policy, there's a certain degree of fact that you put out there. But at a certain age, when you try to impose right or wrong answers as to what policies try to do and what it achieved, if you do it a bit too bluntly, and teenagers being teenagers will always be a bit cynical, and they'll say, okay, when do you cross the line into propaganda and, oh my God, you're pushing down this kind of information down my throat. At what level do you get there? And I fear that, as I say, kids being teenagers being specifically cynical will take this the wrong way.
That you are trying to push a narrative.
Which, if you want to think about it, I think there's no reason why a 15, 16-year-old kid cannot have the same kind of debate about tax policy as a 25-year-old kid should have a discussion about tax policy. It's just how you do it. I think the way it's taught sometimes for a 15, 16-year-old is just know the facts, just memorize the facts. And if the question asks you this, say this about our MediShield Life policy.
You see, I can understand why they do that. Because like you said, Kapal, it's about maybe just being safe.
Yes.
Teachers need help, I think. You know, I don't blame them for doing it this way because it is the safest way to do it.
Correct.
They need help to generate discussion that isn't offensive, but that actually discusses the pros and the cons of every issue or the various facets of every issue.
Absolutely. So a teacher using, say, this book, which has now become a little bit controversial, can say that, okay, this book asserts A, B, C, D. These are the points. What do you guys think?
Why is it correct? Why is it not right? Why do you feel
arguments on both sides so that the maturity of thought can be both observed as well as expressed and articulated? And in some countries, I've seen exactly these things happen, even in Papua New Guinea. And I've seen teachers encourage the students to discuss these issues with their parents, for example, over dinner. And say, when you come back tomorrow, let's discuss what your parents feel, or your grandparents, if they're still alive. What do they feel? And in this way, you make the person, meaning the student, a lot more, and I think we cannot escape the use of this word, political. In terms of awareness, in
political
terms of
should not be a dirty word, by the way.
No, it's not a dirty word. Because Aristotle said man is nothing if not a political animal, meaning that we think, and after we think, we decide, and on that decision that we then make after thinking rests a lot of consequences. Whether it is, should I go to work today, should I wear this shirt today instead of a long sleeve shirt, any decision, right? Mm. And this is where values come into play. And I think that it's good for young minds that are healthy and robust to be engaged in very good, strong discussions, because otherwise education becomes very timid, you know. And I've heard, even at the university, some visitors come and say that, you know, Singapore should now be ready to confront some hard issues and talk about them.
Mm. And you know what? Economic inequality, that's one of them.
Whether is it really and necessarily true that everything that was decided by the government of Singapore over the last 50 years, say, when we are celebrating our 50th anniversary, have all been good? Mm. Of course, in the context of celebration, yes, we adore and we adulate and we admire. But in the confines of a classroom where we're talking intellectually, there has to be that sufficient distance to say, okay, even if 99% of us agree, let's listen to that one voice that is saying, I disagree.
And
let's
why?
See are there merits in that disagreement? Are there things that we in our jubilation are missing? Mm. Are there things that because we are concerted to say we may overlook, which in the longer term may be to our detriment? And Mr. Lee Kuan Yew himself, in meeting with university students when I was younger, used to say that the time will come when we too will need to engage with very sensitive issues, even wrong assertions, and try to undo the power of persuasion that that particular wrong statement might contain. I think here the question is, should this have taken place at Sec 3, Sec 4, or maybe pre-university 1 or 2? You know, where do we think the young person is so vulnerable that it'll be like a glue, you know, it'll stick there? Or when will the young person be seen to be mature enough to say, hey, this is an opinion? Now, is it an opinion or a fact?
But ultimately, you can't wait for people to get ready.
Yes.
You know, you have
to prepare them.
Yeah, you've got to prepare them. You've got
Correct.
To expose them
Correct. That's
to
what
the stimuli.
Education is about.
Yeah.
That's what education is
so
about.
So my fear is, you know, we've all talked about the fact that it's important to have a discussion about these things.
Yes.
It shouldn't be a static text
Correct.
For you to look at and then form your own opinions and walk
Correct.
Away feeling one way or the other.
Correct.
But we talked about how perhaps not all teachers are equipped with the ability to do this. Not because they don't know how, but maybe there are some fears or some apprehensions
Anxiety,
about
yes.
it. Mm. And parents, are they equipped with the ability or the wherewithal to do it? Are they willing to have difficult discussions? Or are they going to say, son, daughter, this is the wrong thing, please don't read it? Because that's not a discussion. Huh? You've got to say, let's look at this. A lot of people are upset about it. How are you feeling about it and why, right? So are people in society, can people in society realistically be expected to do
this?
I think
everybody needs to be educated. Right? When, you know, somebody reads and says that, you know, 82% of Singaporeans live in public housing estates, that phrase, public housing estates, can vary with country to country, from country to country, in terms of what it implies.
Yeah, because in Singapore, it means something quite different from what it means in the UK,
Correct.
For instance.
So
yeah.
Singaporeans need to come and understand that. Now, is that necessarily a bad thing? But so long as there's a kind of stigmatization that is attached to, say, the HDB, meaning that you're still living in a HDB, like, huh?
Mm.
I thought, you know, I mean, you're earning 20,000 a month. Why are you still in a HDB? Or
have
whatever
you looked
the
at
rules
the prices
are, right?
of HDB flats lately?
So I think everybody needs education here.
Yeah.
And I would say this book, I mean, you know, it's unfortunate that it's come under the spotlight in this particular kind of way. But I think in the longer term, this would be seen to be a moment of maturity. You know, maturation is part of the process. I mean, a lot of people are out there who want to distort facts, right? Mr. Lee Kuan Yew always used to say that his political opposition guys want to distort the facts. But we need to train our young people to discern the distortions from the fact. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the distortions may come from an agency or an individual that they might have been told to respect. But then when the so-called facts presented by these agents are discussed, they then discover that, hey, sometimes, you know, as people say, there are facts and there are facts. And the perception may not necessarily always equal to 100% reality.
This actually goes back to another issue that's been in the news lately, online falsehoods,
yes.
deliberate online falsehoods.
Yeah, fake news.
So it's all about critical thinking, knowing what the source is, why it was said a certain way, what's the context?
So yeah, it goes back to actually a separate issue, which is the way in which the person who posted this photo of this book, the way he did it and the reactions that followed as well. Because yes, when you take a very isolated photo like this, you post it on social media, yes, it gets all sorts of traction. But then I wonder how many people actually said, okay, let's stop. Okay, let's get a hold of the book, let's look at the chapter, let's look at the whole thing, let's see where the flow is, and then we make our judgment. But the way that social media works, which goes back to how these online falsehoods are perpetuated, is that everyone feels compelled to make judgments very quickly on the spot, and then it goes viral, which is very unfortunate.
So we need to be educated to read.
To take a step back. I think one of the weird things about social media is that it has a weird psychological effect on one's brain, in that you no longer have the luxury to take 5 minutes to have a thought about it before you press like or share or whatever the case may be. So in this particular case, I think it's perfectly indicative of the problems that are out there when it comes to sharing things on social media.
And in addition to that as well, Jamie, is the fact that once these observations are made, social media has two very almost polarized ways of being received. One is, oh my God, it's there. And everybody gets very, very agitated, excited, enthusiastic, whatever word you want to use, depending which side of the fence you are. On the other hand, there are enough people who say, alamak, why give it so much credence? You know, social media, what's news today, tomorrow, people forget really.
Yeah.
You know, they don't remember it. It's not like going to be there in the brain for the next
That's
2 years.
That's also true, yes.
And because of that, maybe we get overly excited about issues. And that's why some people say, Singapore is so good that the, you know, issues like this begin to obsess, you know.
There are no more important things to get worried about. Right, yeah.
Yeah. But one would say this is an important thing, you know.
That's right.
It speaks of what perceptions people might form of each other.
Sure.
You know, so, or how someone might actually start to perceive themselves.
Sure. People need to come out and actually take ownership of things. I mean, I can tell you very honestly, right, that people, even today, are very surprised when they say, where do you live, Kapa? And tell them, I live in a HDB flat in, you know, Choa Chu Kang. Mm. You see from the faces, like, huh?
Yeah, you're like, a professor.
You're a prof for 45 years and you're living, like, what's the matter with you? You know, what kind of problems are you having, or what? Why, you know?
You must have saved a lot of money somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, so they begin to then, you know, talk among themselves.
That's very common.
And
yeah,
all of that, right?
Yes.
So, but for me, it's good to be out. Right, the money that I have not spent on buying, say, a private property,
exactly.
I spend quite lavishly on travel.
Yeah.
I like traveling because I see travel as education. So from young,
good for you, yes,
take the family out and all that. Mm. But we must be sufficiently brave or strong, or have the, you know, presence of mind at some point, not to feel embarrassed by acknowledging it or talking about it. Mm. Now, there are a lot of values that Singaporeans feel they have to embrace, or else they are seen to be somehow lesser, inferior human beings and all of that. So I think the controversy about this, for me, is a very, very good, you know, step and stage in our maturation in the process to be more open and more discussive about issues which may be a little touchy.
I think the point is, let's not oversimplify anything.
No,
and if you feel that this book has oversimplified the issue, it's time for us to also then have discussions with our children on how not to, you know, or what is the way ahead.
Yes.
So if we were to talk about immediate solutions, I mean, since this incident has presented an opportunity for teaching moments, many, many teaching moments, if you take it in the right spirit, what is the way ahead? You know, to create this society where perhaps we don't jump at everything we see on social media, we don't make snap judgments, and instead of only getting upset and angry about something like that, we decide to choose to have a discussion.
Absolutely. I was very blessed. I mean, some of my secondary teachers would deliberately say, I'm going to give you two or three ideas which are actually quite faulty, but I want you to speak about them in a debate, to see how the other side is going to handle and engage with this obviously misleading statement.
Fallacies, right?
I wonder, that's very good, no?
Since this was a Sec 3 guidebook, I wonder how many Sec 3 social studies teachers at the moment teaching this particular chapter, this particular topic, went back to their students and said, hey, did all of you see this thing going
That's
around?
Right, yeah.
Let's talk about it, right?
Yeah. Do you actually feel all the things that have been going around in social media? Why? Yeah. Do you think it's good? Do you think it's accurate, inaccurate? What are the biases? What are the assumptions? I wonder whether anyone did that.
Mm. What a great opportunity, though.
It's
a wonderful moment. Teachers
I fear they may not have because it would just be taking up curriculum time, right?
That is the point.
That is a real problem.
You know, we were talking about how parents may not have time to have such discussions with their kids. Do the teachers have time? Education is moving now towards more applied learning, so on and so forth. So it's quite different from when I was in school and when you guys were in school, obviously. Yeah. So I'm hoping that there is room for this type of discussion, because ultimately it's not about jamming facts in your mind. I mean, we're looking at a new economy where disruption is the name of the game, right? And it's increasingly going to be. It's about being analytical, learning to think, learning to adapt. And this is one way of doing it. We shouldn't see discussions like these as a waste of time eating into curriculum time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? If you permit me to say it, as an old and committed Singaporean, there's many advantages of leaving this country but staying put. I would say not only is this good, but we need more of these. We need more blunt assertions, maybe even of a slightly not 100% proof nature, in order to bring in the maturation process of thinking.
Mm. Exercise that muscle, right?
Muscle, yeah. Part of the issue, I think, is that many of our students, when it comes to issues concerning the world at large and concerning Singaporeans' response to the world at large in terms of what we eat, how where we sleep, what we do in our free time and those kinds of issues, we have found wanting. We are found to be pretty juvenile in terms of our thinking. So I think this, to me, is in any sense, from whichever angle you look at it, whether the book is right or the book is wrong, it has provided us with a wonderful golden moment, as you say, Bharati, to talk about issues and then educate ourselves in the process.
So clearly, more needs to be done about literacy, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Information literacy.
How do you read a text?
This also actually raises the issue of what's really out there in the world of assessment books. There's so many. It's a large industry.
Oh, yes.
And how far should parents play a role in selecting guidebooks and assessment books for their children? My stand is, again, you know, it shouldn't be a top-down thing. You don't tell your kids, only read these books and none of the others that are in the market. I think let them expose themselves to whatever is out there, but make sure that you are able to sit and discuss whatever questions they might have as a result of having read some of these guidebooks or having been exposed to the other assessment books on the market.
Absolutely. A wise teacher of mine used to say that there is a group of people we call educated. There's another group of people we call non-educated, uneducated. And there's a third group that are miseducated. And I think the miseducated one, he said, is the most dangerous.
But that's subjective, because if our standpoints differ, I could say you're miseducated and you could say I'm miseducated.
Correct.
Just because we disagree on something.
Correct. Right? So I think the way forward in this is not to immediately clamp and say this is so bad that it must be taken away from, you know, every classroom or every student school bag. It's a lesson for everybody, from parents, but especially to educators. And I hope that our NIE, our National Institute of Education, that trains teachers, are strong enough to say, yes, the time has now come to actually suggest ways and strategies by which our teachers can handle controversy even at Sect 3. And I think this is one very necessary stage in that preparedness for the world. Mm. Because the world will lie, the world will distort, the world will present a myriad of images for us.
Including oversimplifications.
Including oversimplifications and overgeneralizations. But we need to have the critical maturity to, one, discern that, and two, to then respond to that discerning mind.
Mm. Yeah. So critical thinking, analytical thought, discernment.
And no knee-jerk reactions.
Yes,
exactly.
I mean,
you know, meditate on it a little bit, reflect on it a little bit.
Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you,
And I do hope that teachers, parents, whoever has contact with kids who might have been exposed to this book, have those intelligent discussions. Many thanks to my guests today, cultural critic, educator, poet Kirpal Singh, all about reading between the lines, and chief editor of Channel News Asia's digital news desk, Jamie Ho. Thanks for joining us on The Pulse.